Hi everyone, welcome to the second podcast of the series Standing on Points, the History and Culture of Punctuation. This episode is called Mind the Gap, the History of Punctuation from Classical Times to the Renaissance. And I was supposed to record a very long but very potted history of punctuation in the West. But I thought rather than have a 90-minute podcast or me rambling on, I would cut things up and make it shorter and sweeter and have perhaps two or three parts depending on, I guess, where my thought goes. So this part is from, I guess, the Greeks and the Romans to around 13th century, 14th century. And I thought it was a natural sort of pause, a natural, let's say, semicolon provided by the invention or the popularization, I guess, of the printing press in 1450 or in the second half of the 15th century. Because from then on, just the ability, the spreading of the word and of printing, and with that also of punctuation, takes on a whole different level, which is probably comparable to our digital age. So I think, I don't know yet, but it might be worthwhile to then also have a break, another comma or semicolon, just before the internet is being invented. And which actually, or just popularized, which would be the sort of 90s, early 2000s. Because really the internet, at least the widespread use of the internet and of texting and messaging and digital and instant messaging is quite young. But this remains to be seen. So for now, this podcast is about the early history of punctuation in the West, I do have to say. From classical times to the Middle Ages, and I will call it Mind the Gap because it's all about pausing. I mean, generally punctuation is of course all about pausing, but this is about the introduction of early pauses. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about grammar and speech and recording of speech, turning that into writing, although I promised there won't be much grammar in these podcasts, but we do need to engage a little bit, and perhaps we can kind of punctuate the or, not punctuate the or, not you know, put a hole in the or that we have of grammar by saying that I think it's actually quite, you know, up to a certain degree vague discipline in terms of what language does and what we do with language. But we can just dip our feet into that a little bit, or we have to. But I want to start with an anecdote again from my student days. And I was trying to earn some money, you know, just like £5 to have an evening meal. So I went to lots of experiments, and one was in music, in the music department, and we were supposed to listen to music that was unfamiliar to us for probably 1.5-2 hours. So that happened to be a certain kind of Chinese music, I think. And you always had to press a button when you thought that a section had stopped and a new one was starting, or when you thought that something had repeated itself, which is a little bit tricky, I think, because how can I project that into the future? But the point, I think, of that experiment was that being unfamiliar with this musical, this cultural background of that particular music, it would be hard for the person doing the experiment to know when a section has stopped, because music, at least parts of music, or what music is not biological but cultural. And something similar happens in language too, because now that I'm speaking, because you know English, you can tell when a certain word starts and stops. Although you don't know what I'm saying, but you can still make sense of what I say without having a visual flash or whatever when a word stops. And this is actually a sort of miracle of the human brain, because that moment when one word stops and another starts, in linguistics is called juncture. And we don't need any signposting in language to know when a word stops and starts. And that comes with a certain familiarity in the specific language. But it also there's also a certain kind of biological substrata, I guess. Although there are funny gaps or funny possibilities with this juncture, which of course are exploited by comedians and sketch makers. For instance, there's, I don't know, I can maybe link it or something, a sketch where a man goes into a shop. It's from the 60s British sketch. And he goes into a shop and he says, I want to buy four candles. Yeah, I want to buy four candles. And the guy gives him four candles to light. And he says, no, four candles. And then he goes back and he gives him fork handles to dig in the garden, or to, I don't know, to eat or whatever. So this kind of continues. There's lots of other words that sound similar. So it's quite hard to tell the difference if you just have that word or those two words, not in a context, but even just a sentence. There's no difference, I guess, that we are conscious of between four candles and four candles, right? I mean, one can stress, now that I'm self-conscious, I can stress it in different ways. But there's plenty of other examples. For instance, I think we all know that ice cream and ice cream. Again, it's a question of stress, but I could just as well say ice cream, and I'm shrieking, but it sounds like ice cream. And something else, another example would be that stuff and that's tough. So that stuff and that's tough. So there's plenty of opportunity to make jokes and to just explore that beauty of that ambiguity, I guess, between words and pauses and what the brain is doing at that point, and also the necessity to have context, and especially in spoken language, to have pitch, gesture, facial expressions, and so on. And from juncture, one easily arrives at turn-taking, which is what we do when we have a conversation. So whilst we are talking, we constantly guess when the other person is probably ending their speech, let's say, their utterance, and we can start. And of course, there's a lot of slippage and a lot of possibilities and problems in those transitions. We can interrupt somebody, the pauses can be too long. So there's a lot of exciting stuff that can happen in that tiny, tiny gap between me ending and you beginning. But generally, turn-taking does have a biological phenomenon, because in most languages in the world, the pause between, in the flow of a conversation, the pause between one person stopping and another interlocutor starting is 200 milliseconds. And the margin between, let's say, Danish and Korean might look a lot if it's, you know, if it becomes a couple of more milliseconds, but it's actually quite similar. So you do have some languages that take a bit more time, in quotation marks, but taking a bit more time is really relative in that context. So we do that incredibly fast, and we guess and we project and we predict the future, or when the other person has stopped speaking or is going to stop speaking. And just to compare that a little bit, it takes three times the amount of that pause when we sort of step into that gap and we take the word takes 3 times more, namely 600 milliseconds, for us to retrieve a word from memory. And it takes another double of that, almost 3 times the amount, 1,500 milliseconds, to bring that word from memory onto our tongue to be able to speak it. So that means that whilst the other person's talking, we constantly integrate all the messages that we get from the words, the meaning of the words, the behavior, the posture, the tone, the facial expression, the gestures, and so on. We constantly have that feedback and we prepare our response while the other person is still talking. And that doesn't mean that we don't engage with what they are saying, but it just means how incredible the brain is, that it's, we can just multitask in that way and we can react so very quickly. Why have I said all of those things? Who wanted to speak about the history of punctuation, the early history? Because in language, we don't need any signposting to know if we are familiar with the language, when somebody has, when a word stops and another starts. But in writing, if we wouldn't have spaces and if we wouldn't have punctuation, it would be quite hard for us to figure out the endings and the starts of words, as I've mentioned before, when sometimes in like a children's magazine or a page of riddles in the newspaper, we have those words bunched together. It does take a bit of time to figure out the syllables and the boundaries of the syllables. So we are really adept at telling those boundaries in talk, but the eye and the brain take a long time to figure that out in comparison when we just bunch words together in writing. And so I just wanted to start with that thought that writing needs assistance, needs crutches, as it were, to do the thing that we're actually really, really good at when it comes to talking. And this is sort of the main thought for this part of the history of punctuation. And kind of a leading question is that moment where speech becomes translated into writing, and how can we then make clear that thing that we do very well when we talk? That's sort of the main leading question. And then spinning off of that would be, what are the concepts of writing? What do you think writing is supposed to do? Is it a representation of speech? Is it a representation of thought? What are we using it for? And how are we reading? Are we reading out loud? So do we retranslate it into speech, or are we reading silently just in our minds? Maybe with a voice in our minds again. And then also the question of grammar and rhetoric. So grammar, the structure of sentences and the relationships between words and phrases, and rhetoric, a sort of general understanding of that, or like a working definition that I would put, is the effect of pausing, the rhythm, the intonation, the voice, the performance when we speak out loud, or when we speak out loud in our heads, I guess. So these are sort of the leading questions for this short history. And I mentioned juncture and turn-taking and bunching words together because this is how the Greeks and the Romans write. So I've been trying to find out whether cuneiform and hieroglyphs had punctuation. I'm not quite sure yet. I read different things. But these early writings are, I guess, something else. So for now, I want to start with Greek and Roman writing. Because for the classical times, for ancient Greeks and Romans, writing was a record of speech more than it was a record of thought. So you would be writing in order to give a speech, And writing was understood as a representation of thinking. Mind you, somebody like Cicero, the great Roman orator, would probably rework his speeches. But the main concept was that writing was a representative of voice. And I think that is important because the writing that happened in Greece and Rome was called scriptio continua, so continuous script. So there were no spaces between words and there was hardly any punctuation. There was a certain amount, I guess, of a realization of paragraphs, but mostly no spaces, and the Greeks as well had a period of writing in boustrophedon. So they would go from left to right, and then in that line they would just drop to the next line at the end of that line and go from right to left and then drop again and go from left to right. So quite challenging for the eye to be reading that and to make sense of that multilinearity, as it were. So to take with us from that part, Greeks and Romans would be bunching the words together and they would just write in capital letters. Perhaps also because they would carve in stone and you can't carve all those round minuscule letters that we have today, but that came way, way, way later, in stone very easily. So carving in stone would be a bit angular perhaps. So they would be writing in capital letters, which of course in hindsight is capital, but not at the time. They were the only letters. And they write without any punctuation, without any spaces in between. What does that mean for a person reading? So you wouldn't be able to read out loud if you get a piece of writing and you were unfamiliar with it. And there's an anecdote that I should dig up of somebody, a politician, and people give him they shove a text into his hands, and there's lots of people standing around. So this was in Rome, classical Rome, and they say, read that out loud, that speech. And he is very sort of ashamed because he says, it's not pointed, I can't read it, I would make a mess of it. And so you had to sit down and prepare what you wanted to say and how you would want to pronounce certain words. And those were very individual, or probably individual and idiosyncratic marks. Same as today when we have, we give a talk, then we might have a system that's very individual, how you want to stress something or pause, different degrees of pauses. And the same happened in Greece and Rome, where the text would come to politicians or orators naked of punctuation. Also because, as we will realize in these podcasts, punctuating means interpreting. And so if you had a scribe that maybe used to be a slave or that's just working for probably his master, maybe her, I read that there were also female scribes, but their master or their another person higher up the social echelon, they wouldn't be allowed to punctuate because that means interpreting. And so Roman writing is without a lot of interference, let's say. That another reason why that might even be possible without a super great amount of confusion is because Latin is very strongly inflection based, and so you will be able to make sense from a sentence that is perhaps seems a little bit jumbled from our point of view of English, which has a very relatively strict word order. But because in Latin you can make sense from the parts of you can make sense of the parts of the sentence through their cases, through their suffixes and so on, it perhaps allows for greater understanding of the writing without punctuation. And just as a little bracket, I have a very erudite friend from India, and he said that Sanskrit also doesn't have punctuation, or original Sanskrit, old Sanskrit, because, and that's his, these are his words, it's like German and Latin on cocaine. It has so much control over the language in terms of the syntax, in terms of inflection, so grammatical cases, that basically it sort of doesn't need the doesn't need punctuation as crutch for reading. But still, I think even a well-versed Roman would perhaps be able to make sense with just looking at an unfamiliar text, as it becomes clear in that anecdote. Now, just to backtrack a tiny bit, Greeks also had that scriptio continua, but in the 3rd century BC, so I don't know, maybe was it 200 years before, 100 years before Roman sort of dominance, I guess, in the Mediterranean. The librarian, a librarian of the library at Alexandria, that very famous huge library called Aristophanes, basically invented punctuation, which then got lost. But what he invented was a system of dots that would correspond to the units, the grammatical units of the sentence, or the rhythmical units of the sentence. It's quite messy and muddled. But there would be no spaces between words still, so you would still have bunches. But there would be dots at the different levels of the line, so at the bottom, in the middle, and on on top, depending on what unit these words belong to. And that was classical syntax, which more or less thinks about a sentence as a unified whole. So it's where the grammar is complete and the sense is complete, and that would be called the period. We still have that today, or at least it was very much around in Shakespeare's time, or in the 18th century, where you have periodic, I think, syntax, where the sense is very suspended and just comes at the very end of the sentence. So you will have a lot of although, however, when. So dependent clauses start the sentence that are whose meaning only becomes clear when the main clause arrives at the very end. And in doing so, the writer has a lot of possibilities to manipulate meaning and bring stuff together, maybe create a certain rhythm and create suspense as well, and really sort of scaffold their sentence and I guess the pace as well of the reading, be it read out loud or silently or just with their eyes or so. So in periodic writing, there's a lot of gracefulness, I suppose, in terms of structuring. And the main thing to take from periodic writing means that the sentence, you need to wait until the very end to make sense of the sentence, in sort of hindsight almost. And so in classical times, you had that period, that whole unit of sense for one sentence, and then that was subdivided into colons. I don't know the correct plural, but I don't want to be too picky. I'll just say colons. So you had colons where the sense was complete and the grammar too, but there was still something missing. So there was still some kind of continuation or some possibility to continue, sort of a bit like today where we might as well put a full stop. But there's sort of the different shorter sentences kind of hang together, so we would maybe put a colon. And those colons had, again, shorter clauses within them, as it were, and that's the comma. And it's not if I say colon and comma and period, I don't mean those very signs that we use today, like the two dots or the little hook, but all the words as a unit were thought of as a comma. That was the name for the whole unit. In this sense, a comma, where the sense is not complete and the grammar is not complete. And then a colon, where the sense is potentially complete, but and the grammar definitely is. And then the whole period, where you have complete sense, complete grammar, made up of those smaller units. Now, that was a digression. How do I get back to what I was before, where I was? So Aristophanes wanted to signal the rhythm in speaking out and pronouncing and reading great literature, for instance, and mostly came up with his system of dots for foreigners, for non-native speakers of Greek. And it also, I think already back then in the 3rd century BC, there was a drive to preserve those great stories, those great works, that was generally the task of the library in Alexandria. And so he comes up with these, what I call distinctions, so these dots at different levels of the line, and also a sort of paragraph, a concept of the paragraph, which was marked with horizontal signs in the margin, or sort of lines, horizontal just slashes, lines, I guess. But this invention was conveniently forgotten by the Romans, and they sort of went back to what was there before, which is scriptio continua. No such thing as dots, although you know they were still sort of kicking around, and there were some dots in stone carvings, but I can come back to that for another podcast, because runes, interestingly, Celtic runes also have dots in their stone carvings. So, that was Aristophanes, 3rd century BC. Then we go back, we have scriptio continua again. And as the Roman Empire slowly disintegrates, knowledge of Latin, or at least classical Latin, starts to wane too. So fewer and fewer people are able to read those great writings of the sort of recent past. So in, I guess, the kind of 6th, 7th century, 8th century, there was a push by theologians or by educators, by grammarians, to preserve the meaning of those great writings. And of course, also by then, it's sort of the early Middle Ages, you have the Bible, the scripture, which you know puts premium on the text. And it's hugely important that there's no ambiguity in the text, because it's the word of God. So you had better fix that meaning. And how can you fix meaning? Through punctuation. So I guess there's a double speed or a parallel activity in terms of fixing the word, because it's the word of God and we need to be really, really clear what it means and what it says and not leave any space for ambiguity. And then preserving those revered classical texts. And so, certain monks in scriptoria, in sort of writing workshops, let's say, in monasteries, were singled out to keep pointing, keep preserving the punctuation of old works that they were copying onto parchment. I think papyrus by that time was pretty much not used anymore, although there was a lot of overlap too. But let's say they're scratching on, or they're writing on parchment, and they would copy texts, meaning they would put the punctuation into a text that was copied by somebody else potentially. And this was an admired task. So you would be singled out because of your knowledge of grammar to punctuate. But because the school, Latin schools, kept being on decline, a certain Isidore of Sevilla, who was a church, massive, big scholar, church father, theologian, savant, all around savant, he proposed to go back to the pointing system, the distinctions of Aristophanes. And he just redistributed the dots on the line. And he made it very clear that these are largely grammatical divisions. In Aristophanes' time, there was still this sense of this is for rhythm, and this is for speaking out loud. And by the time of Isidore of Sevilla in the 7th century, sorry, there was already a silencing of the word to a certain degree, and a prominence of grammar to think about punctuation or think about the text. And up to that time, people would probably read out loud when they were reading, even when somebody was in their own room. I think there is an anecdote where somebody came into the cell of St. Augustine, another huge church father, I think 3rd or 4th century, I can't quite remember, but definitely earlier than Isidore. And this person later said that they were shocked because St. Augustine was only reading with his eyes and not with his voice too, although he was alone. And that was kind of a revelation, as it were, that was also possible. So people really connected reading with speaking. But by the time, as time goes on, and writing in general becomes more, more maybe intellectualized, or maybe retreated from public life, as it was very much the case in ancient Greece and Rome, people think of writing as not just a representation of speech, but also as a representation of thought that can also be produced and consumed silently. And so there is a movement from thinking about punctuation as helping you to speak out, to punctuation as helping to make sense of something potentially unfamiliar. And so Isidore of Sevilla in the 7th century writes his Etymologies, a very big and very, very influential work on, I guess, a dictionary or lexicon. Rather, and he says that we should punctuate, going back to those dots from Aristophanes, just redistributed. And he also mentions the dipple, which is something like, I don't know, it's like a V, just horizontal, and that people would put that if they wanted to mark that a certain line as a quotation, which is, of course, super important when you think about the Christian context, where people would quote from the Bible and then write a commentary on it. So they had to make sure that they marked that particular portion out as coming from the Bible, as being a quotation. So they used those sort of V-shaped horizontal shapes in the margin. That's called the dipple. So Isidore mentions that too. He also mentions the question mark. So by the 7th century, there was already a kind of arsenal, a kind of repertoire of marks. But it was really a very patchy, very uneven, I don't even want to say development, but there is some kind of development and some kind of change in concepts and practices and habits and things. But there was a lot of overlap and a lot of idiosyncrasies. Some writer would put the dot a little bit higher, a little bit lower. And just with us, our handwriting is different. And maybe somebody would just today write an exclamation mark a little bit in the shape of a question mark and so on. So nowadays, of course, when we go back, it makes it a little bit hard to trace histories and to create narratives and create stories around that. But that's sort of more or less the path, I suppose. And something to mention still is that there were still no spaces between words. So even Isidore in the 7th century, going back to Aristophanes from well, 600, 1,000 years, how many years? Yeah, 1,000 years, 900 years earlier, still doesn't think that one can mark the, or one has to mark the beginning and the end of a word. Still, it's still a very grammatical kind of thinking, and some words are still bunched. And but that wouldn't need a long time. We don't have to wait for long, because just 100 years or so afterwards in Ireland, some monks are also copying texts, but they find it quite hard to get the Latin. And that's called parsing, when you have to find out the structure of the sentence through looking at the grammatical endings and what kind of part of speech that word is. That's called parsing. So these monks find it quite hard to parse Latin. So what they do, even in the system of like of dots and stuff, what they do is to just put a tiny little bit of space between the words. It's so easy, but it's a huge leap of development and of invention, really. And from then on, the sort of the spaces between words is spread throughout manuscripts, and that starts to be done too. Not to the same degree, there are different levels of spacing, but sometimes quite close together, because parchment might be wear, or the writing might have a certain kind of beauty. The more the denser together, the more beautiful. The more dense, the more beautiful. But the spaces were being invented, really, in this leap of invention, because people wanted to be able to read, I guess, faster, better, more clearly, and not have this task of having to find out the grammar, so that they could just catch the word and the sentence or the comma and the colon faster with one glance of the eye. At the same time, also in the 8th century, you have the empire of Charlemagne, and he has an advisor called Alcuin, and he was a monk from York. I think he was bishop probably even of York, and he came to Charlemagne and wanted to have him because he was such an educated man, and he had him as his tutor for his children. And Alcuin also helped spread the point system of Isidore, or Aristophanes, as it were, going back to that even. And what he did was to invent minuscules. So until that time, people would write in capital, what we now think of as capital letters. And what he did was to, I'm not an expert on that particular script or development, but he helped instigate or institute minuscule writing. And that is another push towards more legibility, more space, I guess, in the writing, to have more marking again, because if you capitalize everything, like when we shout today in our text messages, it becomes hard to read, and it becomes, imagine that all of this bunched together, it becomes even harder to read. So sometimes when we hashtag, we want to make sure that people can read maybe the 3-4 words that we hashtag together, and then we capitalize them, even though they might not usually be capitalized, like A or the. So capital and minuscule letters also help in one word or in one sentence help reading and help catching the sense at one glance, as it were. So that's more or less it for the very early history of punctuation in the West. So we have, as a recap, we have writing bunched together, written in just a continual line, two inventions of dots to mark grammar, Aristophanes from the 3rd century before Christ in Alexandria, and that gets forgotten again, so Romans go back to the bunching together, and slowly we move into Christian Europe, where sense needs to be fixed. So a return or a revival of those dots from back then, and eventually the invention and the introduction of spaces between words, all in the name of legibility, in the name of better, faster understanding, and in the name of fixing words or meanings. And with that, one can read a change in concept of what writing is and writing is supposed to do, and what reading is and is supposed to do. So I guess this was longer than I had intended it to be, but this is the first part, and the second part will pick up on that and start in Italy in the 13th, 14th century with more inventions such as the exclamation mark and the brackets, which are very close to my heart. And then we move into the time of the printing press up to sort of, I guess, 1980s, going up to the Xerox machine or the typewriter, all of those different kinds of technologies that we have that it's important to look at too, because they also have impact on what kind of punctuation we use or how we use it. So that was it for part one. So I hope that when you write now, you can mind those gaps that we so seemingly naturally and without thinking put into our writing, which is, you know, the most basic of gaps is just the space between two words. And I hope that you appreciate the amazing nature of the human brain when we talk and we can tell when a word stops and starts. So see you next time for the second part of the history and culture of punctuation.